Joanne Lublin is the former management news editor for the Wall Street Journal. She also was its career advice columnist for nearly 30 years and chaired the journal's 2003 Pulitzer Prize for stories about corporate scandals. She won the 2018 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Gerald Loeb Awards, the highest honor in business journalism. Her inspirational prior book is entitled Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. She earned a bachelor's degree in journalism with honors from Northwestern University and a master's degree from Stanford University. She lives in suburban Philadelphia. Joanne has very kindly joined us to talk to us about her new book, Power Moms. Joanne, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Pleasure. So, Joanne, how did this book come about? What was inspirational in to writing it?
Well, as often is the case, one book gives birth to another book. And so my first book, which came out in fall of 2016, looked at 52 high-ranking corporate executive women who had overcome both personal and professional setbacks to become better leaders. And when I took a closer look at those women in writing that book, I discovered that most of them also had children. But when you looked at those who had become public company CEOs, of which that was a majority of those 52 women, and these were women like Mary Barra at General Motors, the proportion who had had children was even higher, which made me wonder, you know, what was special about what they were able to achieve as female executives and also as mothers. And especially since I did have one chapter in that first book on that topic. It was called Manager Moms Are Not Acrobats. And that was a quote from one of those 52 executives. All but one of those 52 executives were women from my generation, the boomer generation, which also made me curious as to whether things were different, harder, or easier for women who in more recent years and who are younger are moving into executive roles and also have children. So for Power Moms, How Executive Mothers Navigate Work and Life, I interviewed 86 women from these two generations, from the boomer generation and the younger generation, who were both millennials and Gen Xers, most of them Gen Xers. In addition, I talked to 25 adult daughters of those boomers to find out what was it like growing up with a mom who was in a very big job. Was this something that these young women, as they grew up, decided they wanted to be just like mom, or did they want to do something totally different? And on top of all this, my publisher, who was the same for both books, insisted that I start every chapter of the new book with a personal story about my own journey as a working mom in order to show that this was something that was a common experience for women at all levels, because I myself never became an executive, first-line supervisor was about as far as I got in my career.
There's some very interesting statistics about how women now occupy more top corporate jobs than before. I think since 1996, was it 10% of corporate boards were female? 10% of women made up 10% of corporate boards, but now it's 20%.
And it keeps climbing. And similarly, the representation of women in senior management has been increasing. It's now at major companies about one in five. And as of the latest lineup in the Fortune 500, we have a record number of women CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And Katharine Graham was the first female CEO of a Fortune 500 company in 1972.
Has the increased number of female CEOs, has that helped raise awareness in companies?
Well, I think the gradual progression of women generally into higher management roles, not specifically just as CEOs, but into executive level positions, I think has had a huge difference. And frankly, you know, that is one of the three major shifts that I saw between these two generations. And that is that the workplace has changed considerably from the one that greeted me and many of these women in the boomer era when we joined the workforce in the 70s and 80s. So women who are now joining the workforce or have joined the workforce in the last 10 or 15 years came into a world of work where not only there were many more women in management, but they were starting to see women in senior management and, as you point out, as CEOs. And at the same time, employers, especially since the pandemic has occurred, have recognized the demands and needs of working parents, men and women alike, and have adapted accordingly, not always successfully, to some of those needs. So that's really one of the three significant changes that I think have made it easier for younger power moms.
What are the other two?
Well, the other two are, number one is advances in technology. Again, we never could have had this 15-month-long experiment in which most white-collar employees in the United States have been able to work from home if it wasn't for things like this Zoom call that we're doing today. And certainly in, you know, the point when I became a mom, you know, the idea of working from home was a pretty difficult task. If you had a PC at home, you had dial-up. It was slow. And many of these boomer moms either worked late or came home for dinner, went back to the office after dinner, because it just really wasn't practical to work remotely. And so I think the advances in technology, as we've seen by the success of remote work and work from home, have made a huge difference. And the third change, besides the changes in the workplace, is the changes in the relationship in working couples, in career couples, where boomer moms were often not only responsible for most of the childcare and home responsibilities, they felt guilty putting demands on their husbands. There's this one boomer mom in the book who always went home to pick up the sick kid at school and would never have thought, she was an attorney, she would never have thought of calling her husband who worked on Wall Street to ask him to do this because she said he wouldn't do it. Whereas the Gen Xers and millennial women are often making this table stakes at the point when they enter into a long-term living arrangement or get engaged or get married. They basically say, you know, if you want to be part of my life, then you got to agree to, you know, my perspective. We have to come to an agreement on how we're going to share the load. And we have to agree to revisit the topic, whether it's childcare or domestic tasks or deciding whose career comes first. And so they're much more assertive and they feel, I guess a lot of them have read my first book, that they've earned it.
And I might say as well, I remember that some, men today might have grown up, with working mothers and have a more informed perspective themselves.
Absolutely.
There seems to be a kind of dichotomy in terms of identities. At work, people are expected to be all about work. And, you know, you cited the culture of workism today. Could you tell us about this?
Well, that's a term that was coined by Atlantic Monthly, and it's this notion that, particularly in recent years, American society has recognized and rewarded those who worship at the cult of workism, which is essentially a philosophy that was established by the high-tech industry and catered to by making sure that you never had to leave the office. You could have your sleeping bag under the desk. You could bring your dogs. You could get everything in your life taken care of, and you just needed to be available 24/7. And that, of course, you know, is at odds with anyone who's trying to have a balanced life or a life outside of work. And I think the demands to be 24/7, or at least to be reachable 24/7, is one that's been embraced or at least subscribed to a greater degree by this younger wave of individuals that I wrote about in the book. Frankly, because it wasn't technologically possible to be always on when you only had computer dial-up. But I also think that the work from home experiment that has been so successful and that I think is going to continue to be not only tolerated, but fostered by smart employers who want to retain and attract key staffers, particularly those with young children, that has also laid bare the shortcomings of workism and the shortcomings of being always on, and has also made it much more difficult, frankly, to turn off. Because if you are now sleeping at the office because it's your home, when do you stop work?
It seems that there's always, you know, people are always going to feel very guilty. They're going to feel guilty in terms of work because they do anything else, and anything else is a distraction from work. And they'll feel guilty with their families because they're working and they're not being there 24/7.
I definitely think that is true for parents, but I think it's certainly a truer issue for women than it is for men. Do you have kids?
Personally not.
Okay. But I have done many podcasts with working dads. Since this book came out, and I've asked every single one, have you ever felt working father guilt? And each one has shared at least one experience where they got late to little Johnny's baseball game and felt bad in the moment, but they didn't like torture themselves with guilt over it. But then they could cite chapter and verse of when their wife or domestic partner experienced the same thing and basically felt tremendous guilt over having been late or missing some important milestone in their child's life. And that frankly goes back to our gendered role expectations and unconscious bias that has both hindered and helped parents. So to the extent that men are not expected to be hands-on parents, they can devote themselves 24/7 to their career without huge amount of guilt. And to the extent that women are seen as the primary parents in American society, even today, they are going to give themselves a lot of guilt. Frankly, it's a waste of energy.
Could it also be that men traditionally, because they're viewed as providers by being right at work, they're seen as fulfilling that, you know, that paternal role because they're thus providing for the family?
Absolutely. But again, that gets back to what it is we think that little boys have to be when they grow up and what it is we raise them to be perhaps differently. And it's why you see still even today, a relatively small proportion of men taking paid parental leave when it's being given to them or offered to them by their employers. Increasingly, at least at the biggest companies, for the same generous amount of time as the being offered to the new moms. And yet, unless the culture has changed, unless there are significant role models at the top of the house, men are going to worry about being seen as somehow less committed to their careers, as less fulfilling of society's expectations as to what a good father is or a good man is, i.e. the provider, like you said, then they're not going to be willing to go that kind of route.
And I remember seeing some statistics in terms of gender pay gap. And I remember that it was, there always would kind of, the gap would widen after childbirth. So I think when women became mothers and they took a few years off to care for their children and they came back, that's when you'd have this widening pay gap.
Correct. And it's simply because it's difficult to make up for lost time, frankly. And we've had thousands and tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of American moms leave the workforce during the pandemic because childcare centers closed, because there was remote learning, because in their household, they were not the primary breadwinner. And to the extent that they stay out of the workforce for more than a few months and instead for several years, they are going to experience that gender pay gap when they try to get back into the workforce. And again, that is why they need to be mindful of that in taking that step backwards. And at the same time, I think American employers have to be cognizant of this gap that is going to be created, this talent loss, and think about ways of encouraging or helping those moms who choose that route to segue back into the workforce when they are ready and able to do so.
And you think now that people are changing, you know, people change jobs and, you know, they change lines much more than before, that that ought to become easier over time to retrain and rejoin. And
it all depends on how hot the job market is. And, yeah, you know, right now, the job market is very hot. I mean, people are offering tens, thousands of dollars in signing bonuses for pretty low paying jobs, simply because they can't fill positions. And so, you know, when the tables turn and the economy is not so strong in terms of the job market, you know, that again puts people who've taken a multi-year break at a further disadvantage, whether it's men or women. Because there are stay-at-home dads too, and let's hear it for stay-at-home dads. And there were, you know, at least a half a dozen women I interviewed for Power Moms whose career took off because their husbands decided to either stop work and raise the kids or choose a career in which they could work from home.
That dichotomy of identity, you know, being good at your job and being a good parent, you mentioned that there can be some way of kind of trying to align them at points where, you know, someone with a good career is also a good role model for their children.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you become a good role model for your children on lots of different levels. And one of the ways you become a good role model for your children is by letting your children know why your job is an important part of your identity and why it gives you satisfaction and why being a parent gives you tremendous satisfaction. You know, looking back at those 25 adult daughters of the boomer moms that I interviewed for the book, they were filled with awe and admiration for all that their moms had achieved and felt that she was a tremendous role model, in some cases, one whose shoes seemed too big for them to fill. But nevertheless, you know, they couldn't stop talking about how much they admired what their mother had achieved. And in some cases, a surprising number of cases, they discovered that their mom was their secret weapon when it came to their own career choices and career advancement. Because as they moved through college and tried to get summer internships or interviewed for permanent jobs, their mom knew their way around the block. She could open doors. She could tell them how to network. She could help them figure out how to make sure their LinkedIn profile got noticed. She could prepare them for job interviews. She could also coach them when they were trying to raise their hand and get their first promotion or fire somebody for the first time. And in several cases, these adult daughters said that their own friends, guys and women alike, would say, "Hey, could your mom take a look at my LinkedIn profile?"
So it really is about being able to balance things out, about finding the right balance. You mentioned at some point yourself, you started having kind of stay at home days. So you went to a four day week, I think, at some point.
Mm-hmm.
How did this help? And you said that, you know, the quality of your articles and the, you know, remain the same, and but you were able to.
Well, what's interesting about my own experience, and remember, I spent nearly 47 years at the Wall Street Journal. It's the only place I worked after getting out of college. And I did not realize how much value I was bringing to the newspaper at the point when I asked for a reduced work schedule. I had two kids under 4 years old, and working full time was really difficult. And so I proposed a 4-day schedule, and I offered to take a 20% cut in pay, 20% cut in benefits. And the Wall Street Journal, I was working in the Washington Bureau, when they did finally give me this arrangement after getting turned down the first time, insisted that I not have to take a cut in pay or benefits, because as my bureau chief, Al Hunt, put it, we believe you will do just as much good work in four regular days, not four longer days, as a lot of the other people in the Washington Bureau do in 5 days. The irony is that when I then talked to Al Hunt for the book, he told me that the reason, well, first of all, they thought I was a really good reporter, but he said the real reason that they offered me this deal was they were afraid if I didn't get it, I would quit and go work for a competitor. And frankly, that thought had never crossed my mind, because I didn't think highly enough of myself, which is, you know, gets back to a really prevalent issue that I talked about in Earning It, which is the imposter syndrome. This idea that I can't possibly be good enough to, you know, get this promotion or get this great work arrangement or actually be in the room with all these big name people. And so to the extent that women in particular don't value their own achievements and their own skills highly enough, then they are reluctant once they become parents to ask for what they need to make that combination work. And frankly, they should not. And I'm often asked, because I do some informal career coaching through a website called Fairy Godboss, I'm also often answering questions from members of Fairy Godboss about, you know, I just got hired and I'm 6 months or 3 months pregnant. They don't know I'm pregnant. What do I do? When do I tell them? Or I already work at such and such. And I'm afraid that if I take my full parental leave, that my career will go off track. And so it seems to me that women in particular, and men to a lesser degree, need to take stock of who they are and what they are and what they have done, and stick up for themselves when it comes to negotiating pay, when it comes to negotiating a new job, when it comes to negotiating work arrangements that work for them as parents. And so we're seeing many stories now as companies start to reopen offices and give people a chance at hybrid arrangements. Because of this talent shortage, some new hires are saying, I either work remotely 100% or I go work somewhere else. Good for them.
And I think I was on LinkedIn the other day, and I checked, you know, jobs in London, 150,000, jobs in New York, 300,000, remote jobs, 450,000.
There you go.
But how, when you were approaching this and you were like, you know, one of the earlier generations of working moms, how did you, generate a roadmap for yourself?
Basically, I had to do it pretty much on my own. There were not very many women in the news department who had young children. I only knew about a handful, and I wasn't very close to them. I certainly didn't know very many women at other companies who had young children. And frankly, this scarcity of role models did influence my career choices. So at one point, and I write about this in Power Moms, I was in my late 20s. I was in the Chicago Bureau. I did not have children. I was married to a journalist, a guy I had met working on the college newspaper. And the then bureau chief approached me and three other star reporters in the bureau, all the other three being all guys, and asked each one of us if we wanted to be a bureau chief as our next assignment at the Wall Street Journal. This is the late 1970s. There are no women bureau chiefs, and there certainly aren't any women with children in the news department that I was aware of. And because I worried about the possibility of my husband not being able to find a job if I got chosen to be a bureau chief in a small city where his employer had no offices. He worked for Business Week. And because I knew at some point we wanted to have one child, that was all I could envision, I, in the moment, said to the bureau chief, not now, maybe later. And essentially ruled myself out of the running for a bureau chief's job, rather than saying, let me have a day or two to think about this and I'll get back to you, which again, I regret because I never did become a bureau chief.
Nonetheless, you still rose in a prominent position in your career, and you seem to, you know, been able to manage it very well with your children. And how did you still, you know, find the balance that you did in terms of, you know, coming up, you know, finding, you know, expressing it to your children what you were doing, sharing it with them, you know, spending the Fridays with them. I mean, you know, that must have been, you know, you need quite a lot of courage to actually go through with that, and, you know, without having lots of other people do it.
Well, yeah, it took a lot of courage, but it also required a fair amount of ignorance, frankly. You know, none of us is perfect, either as an employee or a parent. And in reporting this book, I extensively interviewed both of my now grown children. And I found out from talking to my daughter, Abra, that, you know, she wasn't always a happy camper growing up. And in fact, at one point when she was age 12, I asked her to, or I taught her how to do her own laundry. And asked her in interviewing her for this book years later how she felt about having to do her own laundry. And she couched it in terms that really surprised me, which was she felt like that everybody in the family had to row the boat that would help mom's career, and this was part of it. And to me, that was laying a guilt trip on me, although she didn't see it that way. And so I then reached out to my son and asked him the same question, because I seem to recall making him do his laundry when he was 12 as well. And I was like, how did you feel when I insisted you start doing your own laundry when you were 12? And he said, didn't bother me. That was the first summer I went to this enrichment program. It was a summer program for gifted and talented children. And they sent a packing list that basically said, this is a 3-week long program and we don't do laundry. You should send along detergent and make sure your child knows how to wash his clothes. And so if he hadn't learned to wash his clothes before he went off at age 12, he would have been wearing dirty clothes for 3 weeks. And in the same token, when she turned 12, Abra also got chosen for the same gifted and talented program and also had to learn to wash her clothes. But I had totally blocked this out. And so when she tells me about how she viewed this, I'm suddenly, you know, once again, get hit between the eyes with that good old working mother guilt, which frankly, I had been blissfully ignorant of at the time it happened.
Well, you'll see what, you know, how your daughter handles the same thing when she comes around to those challenges herself.
Well, she has two cats and does not plan to have children. In fact, after reading the book, she said she was glad she had chosen not to have children. It seemed like a really very impossible job. So, my son, on the other hand, has three children and a wife that works full time and has a pretty demanding career, as does he.
So I guess to each their own. You share some strategies, a series of kind of strategies towards the end of the book. Could you tell us about some of them?
Are we talking about the ditching the guilt strategies, strategies that employers ought to pursue?
Ditch the guilt, ditch working over guilt.
So remember, there was that chapter in Earning It called "Manager Moms Aren't Acrobats." That was a direct quote from one of those 52 women that I interviewed for that book who had children. She, in turn, along with about a half a dozen of those 52 women, are making a repeat appearance in Power Mom. And she's the one who suggested I include a chapter on ditching working mother guilt because she thinks it's a complete and utter waste of energy. And so one of her suggestions is, when you, once again, as you do most nights as a working mom, are sitting down for dinner with your children and your better half, at 7 o'clock, rather than give yourself a hard time and yet another guilt trip of, OMG, it's already 7 o'clock and we're just barely eating dinner, celebrate the moment. In other words, look at the situation as the glass half full and celebrate the fact, isn't it wonderful that I'm getting to eat with my family? By the same token, another tip that came from her was this idea of involving your children in your work life. Not only making them understand that this is something that is important and meaningful and gives great hope or help to a large part of society, because whatever it is you're doing is obviously a useful task, but make sure that the children understand why, for instance, you may have to take business trips. And try and make sure you can, to the extent you can plan these trips, to arrange them around their school schedule. And in her case, if she had to be out of town when there was an important kids event, she would make sure that the next trip would be scheduled in a way that she wouldn't miss the one that came after that. And by the same token, it also means, and this was another, a third tip that I'll share from the 10 hacks for how to ditch working mother guilt, actually schedule part of your vacation time as mommy days. In my case, I started doing this when we lived in London. I would, when the kids had a spring break, each one would get a mommy day. And the first time I did it with my son, we're living in London. And I said, you can choose whatever we do for the next 8 hours. Ever spend 8 hours in a toy store? In London? We did. Now, one of those executive moms from the younger generation that interview for Power Moms, she takes a couple days off once a quarter because she has three kids, three boys, and each one gets a mommy day. And she does this purposely so that they understand how special they are in her life. And it certainly eases her working mother guilt.
Just want to tell you, kind of in this kind of thing of having a finding the right childcare provider and, you know, enlisting kind of family help.
That's another good cure for working mother guilt.
It's kind of very important as kind of good management to be able to, you know, bring in skill sets and also kind of be realistic in terms of what one, you know, what one can manage energy wise. I thought that was and I just meant one to other one about kind of taking take carving time out for yourself at times.
Totally important. I well remember the time when Dan was a toddler, and one evening he was playing very peacefully with his dad after we had come home from work and daycare. So I decided to take some time for myself. And I went and took a bath. And of course, I had no sooner gotten into the bath that there was a pounding on the door. Bam, 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 bam. And it's three-year-old Dan. Mommy, what are you doing? I said, Dan, mommy's having some me time. Mommy, I want to have me time with you. Which of course broke my heart, but I also knew that he had a very capable parent out there in the living room waiting to play with Legos. And I said, Dan, go back and play with your dad some more. And when I'm done with my bath, I will read you a good night bedtime story. Okay.
Thank you very much. Joanne, just before we come to the end of our interview today, could you tell us, bring us up to date with what you're doing these days?
Sure. So I retired from full-time work at the Wall Street Journal in April 2018, in part because I wanted to report and write another book, which I have now successfully done. But the journal asked me to continue writing my career column, Your Executive Career, which I did do so until about a year ago. I remain now a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and I'm mostly doing profiles for a feature called Personal Board of Directors, in which I profile high-level executive women as well as people of color. and look at key advisors, key mentors who have helped them not only shape their view of life, but help them progress in their career. And so far, I've done several of those profiles about women highlighted in Power Moms.
Joanne, thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak to us today. You can purchase this book by clicking on the link in this video, which should appear now, and otherwise, of course, on Amazon. And you also read more about what Joanne is doing by going to her website, which we're going to link to below as well. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome. And you're welcome, Alex.